This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Ohio Congressman Dennis J. Kucinich, who's leading the fight in the halls of Congress for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney.
We'll be joined by best-selling author Vincent Bugliosi, former prosecutor and author of the current book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder.
Hear why an incredibly successful former prosecutor thinks George Bush ought to be indicted and tried for murder, and hear why the same person, a best-selling author, is having his book on George Bush's murder indictment ignored by the major media.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Here on Law and Disorder, we've been chronicling for our listeners the various illegal acts of the Bush administration for four out of the last 8 years. Now, in the late stage of their reign, Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio is pushing for impeachment. Last week, the House voted 238 to 180 to send only a single article of impeachment to the Judiciary Committee. That same committee then stopped Kucinich's previous 35 articles in an effort to frustrate any hearing on Bush's crimes. In Kucinich's words, quote, Bush deceived Congress with fabricated threats of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to fraudulently obtain support for an authorization for the use of military force against Iraq. House Judiciary Committee Chairman John Conyers Jr., who had previously been for impeachment, told the Congressional Quarterly, we're not doing impeachment, but he can talk about it. Amongst those articles of impeachment that Kucinich put forward and that were tabled are the following. There are three related to illegal detention of citizens and non-citizens alike, torture and rendition, the exporting of people for torture. There are four more relating to the setting up of a police state in America, including a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, where the military is allowed to do law enforcement, spying on American citizens without a warrant, creating an illegal unconstitutional database on American citizens, and announcing his intent to violate the law by the so-called signing statements, of which he's issued more than all other presidents combined. Other areas that Kucinich covers in his allegations are the failure to plan for the predicted disaster of Hurricane Katrina, failure to adequately address the catastrophe of global climate change, and attempting to repeat the deception in Iraq with what's going on now with Iran. We're joined today with very brave and admirable Congressman Dennis Kucinich from Ohio. Congressman Kucinich, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
It's really an honor to speak with you. You can't imagine how much we admire what you're doing here. Let's jump right into it. You're trying to get President Bush and Vice President Cheney impeached so we can examine their crimes against the American people and the Iraqi people. The Nuremberg trials after World War II established aggressive war as the ultimate crime, and that is Article Number 1 in the 35 articles you have. Can you comment on that, please?
There's no question that Iraq had neither the intention nor capability of attacking the United States. It is a matter of fact that Iraq did nothing to merit the United States attack, that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, that they weren't trying to get uranium from Niger, that they didn't have anything to do with 9/11 or Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. There was no basis in law or fact for an attack on Iraq. Now, you have to look at the consequences of this attack. The deaths of over 1 million innocent Iraqis, the destruction of the infrastructure of Iraq, the destruction of water systems and sewage systems and electrical systems and schools and hospitals, a total obliteration of some areas of the country. There must be accountability. The international tribunals were brought forward because of the devastation that was wrought against civilian populations during World War II by the German Reich. This act of the Bush administration against Iraq, there must be an accounting for that because they have violated international law, and the Nuremberg principles would certainly apply.
Congressman, what do you think the real reason was? I know that there are three articles that you've listed. One has to do with establishing permanent military bases, wanting to control Iraq's natural resources, and then creating that secret task force to develop energy and military policy. Is it your position that oil underlines a lot of what they've done to Iraq?
Yes.
Let me now switch domestically. A lot of the laws and practices that we live under now could be called a destruction of the Constitution, a dissembling of the three branches, of making the executive branch the premier branch. When that happens, you have really a police state, and you've chronicled that in these articles. Could you talk about that, please?
Well, when you break down the separation of powers, and the executive is not held accountable for any violations of law, you set the stage for destruction of the Constitution. In addition to that, when you look at the laws that have been passed by this administration, beginning with the Patriot Act and as of late FISA, you're looking at the Fourth Amendment vitiated. You're looking at the Fifth Amendment under attack. We are in an era where the question remains as to whether or not this nation is going to endure. Lincoln raised that question at Gettysburg at a time of the Civil War. Now we have a struggle that deals with a fake war on terror that's being used to justify every way, shape, and form of violation of constitutional privileges, and not just of American citizens, but of people who have been tortured or detained or renditioned in a manner that is a violation of basic principles of humanity, of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, of every principle of humanity that we have in this country. We're all being vitiated because of this phony war on terror.
What can our listeners, and they're in the tri-state area and across the country and also on our internet radio show, what can our listeners, Congressman Kucinich, what can they do to help you in your effort to bring these people to justice?
Well, I think you have to begin with people being informed. You know, go to the web and read the articles of impeachment. Contact your member of Congress and indicate your support for those articles if you believe after reading them that they merit support. I have a website in my name that's up that people can go to, and Kucinich.us, and get information on that. And if they want to, they can put their names to the petition on the website. I mean, there's so many things that people can do to be active. And also circulate a petition on their own. I just received petitions from people in New Jersey, but they've been circulating petitions all over the country for the purposes of supporting an impeachment. And again, this isn't just about a single crime. This is about a multitude of crimes. This is about government being reduced to a gang that has basically trampled on not just the Constitution, but on the United States Code and international law. So, people, we need your help. I mean, everyone who's listening, we need your help. We need your involvement in any way that you see fit. Our country's at risk. We're losing our country to a war based on lies, to destruction of our civil liberties, and to a Congress that is not being responsive. And so, only the people can help to ignite the people's house with a passion for democracies and a democracy and adherence to the law.
Congressman Kucinich, what is it, and let me ask you a personal question, why are you doing what you're doing? What really was it for you personally that caused you to do what I would characterize as a very bold and brave act?
I love this country. I believe in the historic role of America to be the light of nations. I think the founders had a pretty good understanding of human nature, where they knew the limitations of power, but they also knew the extent that a nation could be created that would adapt to an undreamed of future. And so, because of my love of country, because of my willingness to stand for what I perceive to be what's good and right in America, I have stood up on this matter. But also because there has been a massive injustice done to the people of Iraq. How in the world will we ever be able to repair the breach that has been created, that has resulted in the deaths of over a million innocent Iraqis, that has ruined this nation for the foreseeable future, that has caused the destruction of their basic infrastructure, that makes it impossible for Iraq to be able to wrest its freedom from international bankers down the road. And we, you know, that puts for the United States a chance to have a permanent presence in Iraq, with a permanent bases and an embassy the size of the Vatican. When you consider that there's no intention to leave Iraq, you're looking at the continuation of a monstrous crime against the people of that country, and it's all about trying to grab their resources and control their oil. This is not what the United States should be about. This is not what our nation was created for. You know, we are going contrary to the established role of this country. And so I want to help people remember where we've come from. And I want to right the wrongs that have been created. But the first thing you have to do is tell the truth. And the truth is that this country was lied to take us into a war. And we have to hold those accountable who told the lies. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Congressman, I know that you're rushing off to vote on the House floor right now.
I have 3 minutes.
Okay, and one last question then. What about Iran?
Well, you look at what's happened in Iraq, and it's the approach that's being used to run up to a war against Iran is quite similar. The evocation of weapons of mass destruction, the evocation of a malign intent towards the United States, the projection of Iran's nuclear ambitions to, along with this malign intent, the drums of war are beating here, and are beating quite loudly. We have no right to strike at Iran, and the fact that they have that they are processing uranium is instructive. But we need to work to take a diplomatic approach in our relations with Iran instead of threatening them. And, you know, the only diplomacy that this administration seems to understand is that which comes from the barrel of a gun, which is not diplomacy at all. It's the use of force. I think that the administration's lack of a disciplined approach in our relations with Israel compound this, because there are factions in the Israeli government that are trying to take us into war. Well, I support the security of Israel and certainly the survival of the state of Israel. An attack on Iran would compromise that, and that has to be recognized. So diplomacy is a must. Diplomatic relations that lead to cultural exchanges are essential. We have to get to know each other, not kill each other. And a war there would be absolutely devastating, and I'm going to do everything I can to work to prevent it, as I have for the last couple of years.
We've got one more minute, so one quick question. How are things looking in the halls of Congress in terms of support for what you're trying to do?
Well, you know, it's a long haul here, so I'm going to keep talking to members. I think there are members who are starting to listen. I'm concerned about that interregnum, the period between the election and the inauguration, in which a lame duck president and a lame duck Congress could permit this attack on Iran to happen. So this is one of the reasons why impeachment is necessary, in order to hold this administration to an account so that they don't launch into a war before the next president is sworn in.
Congressman Dennis J. Kucinich of Ohio, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Good luck to you. You've got our support and that of our listeners. We'll put your site up on ours. We hope to talk to you soon in the future. We hope for some victories. Thank you again for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
For links to Congressman Kucinich's website, go to lawanddisorder.org and you'll get the link. If you want to call the congressman down here for Lower Manhattan, that's Jerry Nadler. His number is 212-225-5635. go now to hear an excerpt of a speech on impeachment delivered by Congressman Kucinich on the House floor. Let's have a listen.
Mr. Speaker, I have a privilege resolution. Pursuant to 2A1 of Rule 9, I rise to give notice of my intent to raise a question of privilege of the House. The form of the resolution is as follows, and if it's appropriate, I can continue to read it.
The gentleman may read.
Resolved that Richard B. Cheney, Vice President of the United States, is impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that the following articles of impeachment be exhibited to the United States Senate. Articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives of the United States of America in the name of itself and of the people of the United States of America against Richard B. Cheney, Vice President of the United States of America, in maintenance and support of its impeachment against him for high crimes and misdemeanors. Article 1. In his conduct while Vice President of the United States, Richard B. Cheney, in violation of his constitutional oath to faithfully execute the office of the Vice President of the United States, and to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has purposely manipulated the intelligence process to deceive the citizens and the Congress of the United States by fabricating a threat of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction to justify the use of the United States Armed Forces against the nation of Iraq in a manner damaging to our national security interests. To wit, one, despite all evidence to the contrary, the Vice President actively and systematically sought to deceive the citizens and the Congress of the United States about an alleged threat of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. A, quote, "We know they have biological and chemical weapons," unquote. March 17, 2002, press conference by the Vice President Richard Cheney and His Highness Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa, Crown Prince of Bahrain, Al Sheikh Hamad Palace. B, "And we know they're pursuing nuclear weapons." March 19, 2002, a press briefing by the Vice President Richard Cheney and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in Jerusalem. C, "And he's actively pursuing nuclear weapons at this time." March 24, 2002, CNN Late Edition interview with Vice President Cheney. D, "We know he's got nuclear, we know he's got chemicals and biological, and we know he's working on nuclear." That's May 19, 2002, NBC Meet the Press interview with Vice President Cheney. Quote, "But we know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us," unquote. August 26, 2003, speech of Vice President Cheney at the VFW 103rd National Convention. F, quote, "Based on intelligence that's becoming available, some of it has been made public, more of it hopefully will be, that he has indeed stepped up his capacity to produce and deliver biological weapons, that he has reconstituted his nuclear program to develop a nuclear weapon, and that there are efforts underway inside Iraq to significantly expand his capability," unquote. September 8, 2002, NBC Meet the Press interview with Vice President Cheney. G, quote, "He is, in fact, actively and aggressively seeking to acquire nuclear weapons," unquote. That's September 8, 2002, NBC Meet the Press interview with Vice President Cheney. H, quote, "And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons," unquote. March 16, 2003, NBC Meet the Press interview with Vice President Cheney. Two, preceding the March 2003 invasion of Iraq, the Vice President was fully informed that no legitimate evidence existed of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The Vice President pressured the intelligence community to change their findings to enable the deception of the citizens and Congress of the United States. A. Vice President Cheney and his Chief of Staff, Louis Libby, made multiple trips to the CIA in 2002 to question analysts studying Iraq's weapons programs and alleged links to Al-Qaeda, creating an environment in which analysts felt they were being pressured to make their assessments fit with the Bush administration's policy objectives accounts. B. Vice President Cheney sought out unverified and ultimately inaccurate raw intelligence to prove his preconceived beliefs. This strategy of cherry-picking was employed to influence the interpretation of the intelligence. Number three, the Vice President's actions corrupted or attempted to corrupt the 2002 National Intelligence Estimate, an intelligence document issued on October 1, 2002, and carefully considered by Congress prior to the October 10, 2002 vote to authorize the use of force. The Vice President's actions prevented the necessary reconciliation of facts for the National Intelligence Estimate, which resulted in a high number of dissenting opinions from technical experts in two federal agencies. A. The State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research dissenting view in the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate stated, and I quote, "Lacking pervasive evidence that Baghdad has launched a coherent effort to reconstitute its nuclear weapons program, INR is unwilling to speculate that such an effort began soon after the departure of UN inspectors or to project a timeline for the completion of activities it does not now see happening. As a result, INR is unable to predict that Iraq could acquire a nuclear device or weapon," unquote. B. The State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research dissenting view in the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate also stated that, quote, "Finally, the claims of Iraqi pursuit of natural uranium in Africa are, in INR's assessment, highly dubious," unquote. C. The State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research dissenting view in the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate references a Department of Energy opinion by stating that, quote, "INR accepts the judgment of technical experts at the U.S. Department of Energy who have concluded that the tubes Iraq seeks to acquire are poorly suited for use in gas centrifuges to be used for uranium enrichment, and finds unpersuasive the arguments advanced by others to make the case that they are intended for that purpose," unquote. The Vice President subverted the national security interests of the United States by setting the stage for the loss of more than 3,800 United States service members, the loss of more than 1 million innocent Iraqi citizens since the United States invasion, the loss of approximately $500 billion in war costs, which has increased our federal debt, the loss of military readiness within the United States Armed Services due to overextension, lack of training and lack of equipment, the loss of United States credibility in world affairs, and the decades of likely blowback created by the invasion of Iraq. In all of this, Vice President Richard B. Cheney has acted contrary to his trust as Vice President and subversive of constitutional government, to the prejudice of the cause of law and justice, and the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, Vice President Richard B. Cheney, by such conduct, is guilty of an impeachable offense warranting removal from office. Article 2. In his conduct while Vice President of the United States, Richard B. Cheney, in violation of his constitutional oath to faithfully execute the office of Vice President of the United States and, to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and, in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, purposely manipulated the intelligence process to deceive the citizens and the Congress of the United States about an alleged relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda in order to justify the use of the United States Armed Forces against the nation of Iraq in a manner damaging to our national security interests, to wit, number one, despite all evidence to the contrary, the Vice President actively and systematically sought to deceive the citizens and the Congress of the United States about an alleged relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda.
That was an excerpt of a speech on impeachment delivered by Congressman Dennis Kucinich on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. As the current presidency draws to a close, some members of the Bush administration may be questioning whether they will be prosecuted for war crimes. George W. Bush and other senior officials have enjoyed years of immunity from criminal lawsuits, but once out of office, they can be held accountable. In his latest book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, author and renowned California prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi lays out the legal framework of a meticulously researched case. It puts George W. Bush on trial in an American courtroom for the murder of nearly 4,000 American soldiers fighting the war in Iraq. This case is also about causing the deaths of more than 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, women, and children, the endless trillion-dollar Iraq war, and the isolation of Western allies. We talk with Vincent Bugliosi about his new book. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Vincent.
Happy to be on the show, Heidi.
Vince, you've written this wonderful book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Give it to us in a nutshell. What did Bush do to merit your Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder book?
Well, Michael, I present evidence in my book that proves, in my opinion and the opinion of many people, proves beyond all reasonable doubt that Bush took this nation to war in Iraq on a lie, under false pretenses, and therefore, under the law, he's guilty of murder for the deaths of over 4,000 young American soldiers who have died so far fighting his war. Now, we shouldn't forget about the over 100,000, and that's a very low estimate, 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, women, and children and babies who have also died horrible deaths because of Bush's war. And he's guilty of those murders, but I could establish no jurisdiction in my book for that. But I did establish jurisdiction in the book for going after him for the 4,000 young American soldiers.
You were a prosecutor in your former life, is that right?
Yes.
And you prosecuted how many cases?
Well, 106 felony jury trials. I handled quite a few beyond that, but usually prosecutors only count the felony jury trials.
And how many convictions did you get?
I got 105, but these were all guilty people, so I wasn't accomplishing anything that was extraordinary. The conviction rate is lower than that, it's usually because the DA or the police haven't done their job. But I had 21 murder cases that I successfully prosecuted, so I have a background in law enforcement.
Including, of course, the Manson case.
Yeah, the Manson case, right.
I just wanted to give our listeners some sense that when you speak about the prosecution of George W. Bush for murder, we're speaking with a real authority here.
Yeah, somebody knows how to put together a case. Vincent, you say that Bush lied to the country on October 7, 2002, and that's one of the bases for which you want to go after him. Talk about that, will you?
Okay, well, I have documentary evidence, and by the way, what I'm about to say to you or tell you, to my knowledge, has never appeared in any major newspaper or magazine in America. Why, I don't know, probably just incompetence, but I have documentary evidence that when Bush told the nation on the evening of October 7, 2002, that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, he was telling millions of unsuspecting Americans the exact opposite of what his own CIA had told him just 6 days earlier in a classified report on October 1st. But it gets worse than that. On October 4th, the Bush administration put out an unclassified version of the classified report so they could give it to Congress and the American people. And this unclassified version came to be known as the White Paper. And in this White Paper, the conclusion of U.S. intelligence that Hussein was not an imminent threat to the security of this country was completely deleted. So Congress and the American people never saw any of this. And in my opinion, it doesn't get any worse than this. The question is how evil, how perverse, how sick, how criminal can Bush and his people be? Yet unbelievably, and I don't think there's any other word for it, they got away with all of this. And at least up to now, as many as 100,000 precious human beings are in their cold graves right now, Heidi and Michael, as I'm talking to you because of it. And I do want to say this to your audience, that at this stage of my career, I don't have time for unrealistic, fanciful reveries. I never in a million years would propose a criminal prosecution for murder against Bush unless I felt there was more than enough evidence to convict him and that I was standing on very solid legal ground.
Can you lay out for us the precise legal framework of the case against Bush?
Well, he would be prosecuted identically to anyone else. Not now. He has temporary immunity. But once he leaves office, and this goes all the way back to the Federalist Papers, he can be prosecuted for any crimes he committed while he was in office. I mean, Nixon, when he resigned in 1974, there was quite a demand to prosecute him for Watergate-related crimes, and that's the very reason, the fact that he did not have immunity, is the very reason why Ford intervened and gave him pardon. So what would have to happen here, there'd have to be the impaneling, obviously, of a grand jury by a state attorney general or a DA. And by the way, my publisher in New York sent out a copy of my book to each of the 50 state attorney generals in the country.
That's
with a cover letter, cover letter from me, asking them to read the book. If they agree the evidence of Bush's guilt is clear and there's jurisdiction to start proceedings against him, they can't prosecute him now, but they certainly could impanel a grand jury. They can commence the investigation. And I'm offering my services to the prosecutor in any way he sees fit.
That's wonderful.
Well, it could include being a consultant all the way up to being appointed a special prosecutor. But I'm definitely going after this guy. That may sound presumptuous, but I'm not going to be satisfied until I see him in an American courtroom being prosecuted for murder. Let the jury decide whether he's guilty or not guilty. And if they convict him, it'll be up to them to determine the punishment. One of their options being the imposition of the death penalty, the other options being life imprisonment, and life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
It's a state prosecution is the first thing you've indicated, not a federal. It'd have to be up to a state, presumably where one of its residents was killed in the war. Is that right?
Yeah, I've established, and I spent much time at the L.A. County Law Library and the Ninth Circuit Library working on jurisdiction, because without jurisdiction, you can't proceed. I don't have to tell you folks that. I've established jurisdiction in my book for the Attorney General in each of the 50 states and the approximately 950 district attorneys in counties within those states to prosecute Bush for the murder of any soldier or soldiers from their state or county who died fighting Bush's war in Iraq. And with all of those prosecutors out there, about 1,000 prosecutors, and with all the evidence of guilt that I set forth in the book, I don't think it's unreasonable to believe that at least one prosecutor out there, maybe many more, will be courageous enough to step forward and say, hey, this is the United States of America. No man is above the law. The evidence of Bush's guilt is clear, and I'm going to proceed against him, bring about justice for the American people. And you know there's no statute of limitations for murder. Pinochet down in Chile, 33 years later, they brought murder charges against him, and then Of course, he died, and that aborted the prosecution. So this is something that could happen. What's the probability? Probably not high. But I think as a direct result of this book, there's a substantial possibility that Bush may find himself someday in an American courtroom being prosecuted for murder.
Yeah, the cynicism of Bush was so appalling. I remember at that correspondence dinner when he was doing a pantomime, when he was looking for the weapons of mass destruction underneath the furniture.
And then you
write in your book about how his conversations in the Oval Office, where he talked about how they needed to provoke a confrontation. Talk about that, will you?
Okay, that's the Manning memo. There's a Downing Street memo, which I mentioned in the book. It got a lot of attention, but I think it's somewhat ambiguous. I presented at the trial, but I certainly would not bring him to court on the Downing Street memo. But the other memo, which received very, very little attention, most people, when I talk about it, they don't know what I'm referring to, but is much, much, much serious against Bush, and that's the Manning memo. That's January 31st, 2003. Bush met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair in the Oval Office for 2 hours with six of their top aides, including Blair's chief foreign policy advisor, David Manning. And after the meeting, Manning prepared a five-page memo stamped extremely sensitive in which he summarized what was said at the meeting. And he said that Bush and Blair expressed their doubts that any weapons of mass destruction would ever be found in Iraq. And then he talks about something, and this is not Blair now, it's Bush. He's talking about Bush here. This is the terrible thing for George Bush. He says that Bush was so worried about the failure of UN inspectors to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that he talked about three possible ways, this is Bush, to, quote, provoke a confrontation, unquote, with Hussein, one of which, Bush said, was to, quote, fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Iraq, falsely painted in United Nations colors. And Bush said if Hussein fires upon them, he'll be in violation of UN resolutions, and that will justify our going to war. So here we have George Bush telling the American people, telling the world, that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country. But behind closed doors, this very small man was talking about how to provoke Hussein into a war. Now, I don't have to tell you three lawyers, you know that if Bush honestly and sincerely believed that Hussein was an imminent threat to the security of this country, so he had to strike first in self-defense, the thought of provoking Hussein into a war, by definition, would never, ever, ever have entered his mind. I was on Dennis Miller's talk radio show a couple weeks ago, and Dennis, as you know, fell hopelessly in love with the Republican Party because of 9/11, and I poked fun at him in my book. Anyway, I talked about the Manning memo, and I said, now, Dennis, you're representing George Bush at the trial, and the prosecutor calls Manning to the stand, and he testifies to what your guy testified to on January the 31st, 2003. And I said, Dennis, other than trying to hide beneath the console table, what would your response be to the Manning memo? And Dennis is very quick, very bright, and he said, I'd ask for a recess. Now, no matter how long that recess was, for an hour, a day, a week, or a month, there is no answer to the Manning memo other than guilt, and I have much other evidence in the book.
Would you negotiate a plea with Bush?
Oh, absolutely not. No, absolutely not. But there's a possibility. It depends on what the evidence is. If it's strong enough, then obviously you don't do anything with Bush. But if it's not strong enough, then you shouldn't even be seeking an indictment. But there is that area where you might give some type of plea bargain to Cheney or Rice. It would be, as opposed to death, life imprisonment. And they could probably tell us stuff about Bush that could curl our hair, you know. So I don't know that. But you give a plea bargain to the driver of the getaway car to testify against a stick-up man. It's not the other way around.
I got you.
And Bush is a stick-up man. So, no, no matter what song he sang, if I were the prosecutor, I would not accept anything.
Vincent, the Manning memo, is that classified? How did you get a hold of this?
I did not get a hold of it. It first came out in a book in England by a professor at a university there in London, and he wrote a book, and it's in there. Also, Channel 4 in England saw the document. Also, the New York Times saw the entire document. If you read the summaries in Channel 4 and this professor and the New York Times of what they saw, they're almost identical.
Vincent Bugliosi, best-selling author, former prosecutor, his new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Again, it's called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Thank you again as we continue this interview with you, Vincent.
Well, I appreciate being on the show. One point I'd like to touch upon, because to me it was kind of an emotional underpinning for this book. And it's the fact, and this fact cannot be disputed, and anyone that tries to dispute it is going to make a fool out of themselves. It is incontrovertible that throughout the hell on earth Bush created in Iraq, with over 100,000 people dying horrible, violent deaths, and hundreds of thousands of their survivors, you know, crying hysterically and having terrible nightmares over what happened to their loved ones, George Bush smiled through it all. The evidence is overwhelming, and again, it cannot be disputed, that while young American soldiers, 18, 19-year-old kids who never had a chance to live out their dreams, were being blown to pieces by roadside bombs in Iraq, Bush was having a lot of fun and enjoying life to the very fullest. And your audience doesn't have to take my word for it or the photos that I have of Bush in the book.
Tell us about those photos.
The photos are great. I'm looking at the photos now, Vincent, and you know, of course, they show the tragedy of some of the tragedy of Iraq, and they can't really speak to the total horror of Iraq. And then you have to the photos, you basically say, I mean, he told us this. I'm going to have a perfect day, he said to Laura.
Yeah.
And I had a fabulous year, and we're having the time of our life. So you go on about how, in the face of these photos and this horrendous Iraq war, Bush is having, as he says, the time of his life.
At the very time all this horror, Michael, and death and sea of blood and screams is going, at the very same time he's saying things like that, you know, I'm feeling pretty good about life, and I'm in a great mood. And even if George Bush was only guilty of making an innocent mistake and taking this nation to war in Iraq, not murder, as I firmly believe, with all of the death, horror, and suffering this guy has caused, what type of a monstrous individual is it?
E.L. Doctorow wrote an essay that I found extremely moving about Bush, saying that the man was incapable of understanding the meaning of death. And my question to you, as an experienced prosecutor who's had murderers on the stand and who's understood their motivation and their character, when you look at Bush, what do you see?
You know, I've prosecuted some very evil people, and I've prosecuted people that were not evil, that committed very evil acts. I don't look upon Bush as being evil, but I look upon him as being as a despicable human being who virtually has no redeeming qualities about him at all. I view him as being totally insensitive to what has happened, that he could not care less. I don't even think this man loves America. I don't think he hates America, but I don't think he loves it. I point out in the book, you know, that first 7 years of his presidency, I'm a cipher. I mean, I write books, big deal. I took 3 days off during a seven-year period to celebrate my 50th wedding anniversary with my wife. We went to the desert. During that same period of time, George Bush, the most important man in the world, took 908 days off. Now, he may say that, you know, around the clock, he's president. When he goes to Camp David or Kennebunkport and primarily his ranch house in Crawford, Texas, he's not going down there to work. He's going down there to have fun. 908 days,
that's
about 36% of his presidency. And here's a guy that's not very bright, does not know much, so he should be working around the clock to become more knowledgeable. And he took 36% of his presidency to have fun. It's just outrageous.
Henrik Herzberg, who writes for The New Yorker often, characterized Bush as callow, lazy, and ignorant.
Yeah, he's all of those things, but I think he's also despicable. Any person that can laugh and smile and, you know, cut up and dance and swivel his hips like Elvis to blaring music and joke with friends, slap backs, and while he knows what's happening in Iraq, kids are being blown to pieces by roadside bombs, this is an extremely callous, cold individual. I say he's not evil because he doesn't want to kill people, but he doesn't care. He couldn't care less if they are killed.
Just to sort of go back to the legal framework, you outline a second lie as the basis of the case against Bush. What was that?
Yeah, well, the second lie was Bush successfully convincing the American people that Hussein was involved in 9/11. And we know from U.S. intelligence, the 9/11 Commission, Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, that Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. We know Al-Qaeda was involved. So Bush and his people obviously felt that if they can convince the American people that Hussein was involved with Al-Qaeda, that would mean that Hussein must have been involved in 9/11. Right after 9/11, polls of the American people, open-ended polls, say, who do you believe was involved in 9/11? 3% said Iraq and Hussein. Yet within months, that figure was up to close to 75% of the American people. Now, who was responsible for this dramatic increase from 3% up to close to 75%. It wasn't you, it wasn't I, If it wasn't you and it wasn't I, who was it? You know, Danny DeVito? Obviously, it was George Bush and his administration. How did they do it? Well, one subtle way they did it is that Bush would talk about Hussein being an imminent threat over and over again, and in the same paragraph talk about 9/11. And that juxtaposition to the American people of these words, you know, the American people are interested in their own personal life and whether their team is winning on the ball field. They're not parsing Bush's words, and they hear 9/11, and they hear imminent threat and Hussein, and they put the two together, or the three together, and they conclude that Hussein must have been involved. Then Bush got more blunt and flat-out told lies, saying that Hussein was involved in a terrorist relationship. Not that he was involved in 9/11, but by implication, saying that Bush was involved in a terrorist relationship with al-Qaeda, that Iraq trained al-Qaeda in the use of bombs and in the making of bombs and the use of poison and gases, et cetera, like that. And also that he said you cannot even distinguish Hussein and al-Qaeda when you talk about the war on terror because they're indistinguishable. So the American public said, well, we know al-Qaeda was involved, and if there's no difference between al-Qaeda and Hussein, Hussein must have been involved in 9/11, but he had as much to do with 9/11 as you, I, or an aunt of mine who lives up in Minnesota. But this was a subtle way that he convinced the American people that we should go to war. As late as August of 2006, over 90% of American troops in Iraq thought that they were over there because it was payback time to get even with, you know, Hussein in Iraq for 9/11. So we have this grotesque spectacle of young American soldiers giving up their lives, thinking they're dying for their country, going against the people that are responsible for 9/11, and they had nothing to do with 9/11. And Bush knew this, of course.
A couple of questions, but one is, what would the key part of the indictment look like here? What would it say?
Well, it would say, just like any other indictment, that Bush is responsible for the killing of so many soldiers and that it was an unlawful killing of these people with malice aforethought. You know, because he's president, he's out of office now. It would be an unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought, and the victims would be the 4,000 U.S. American soldiers. I don't know if there'd be any special language in it because he's a former president.
Well, there would be conspiracy as well with
Rice. Yeah, I should mention that. Yeah, he can be prosecuted for two crimes, conspiracy to commit murder and murder. As I mentioned earlier, the DAs or the state attorney generals could go after him. On a federal level, realistically, it would only be the attorney general in Washington, D.C., operating through his attorney general. There are 93 U.S. attorneys around the country, but I think it's very unrealistic that they would bring charges against Bush without getting the consent of their boss in Washington, D.C. first. There would be an indictment. The only difference in this case, as opposed to a typical murder case, is that after the indictment, as you know, there's a motion to quash the indictment, and it's routinely set aside. Now and then it's granted, but very, very rarely. In this case, that would not happen. We would not go from the indictment to the trial. The motion to quash would go automatically. When I say automatically, not automatically, but undoubtedly, it would go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And they'd take it under submission for a long time and probably issue the longest opinion in the history of the court. And I don't see how, at least based on the law, they could say that Bush could not be prosecuted for first-degree murder if a grand jury in Fargo, North Dakota, or wherever, issued that indictment. I don't see what legal basis there would be for setting aside that indictment. But believe me, it would not go from indictment to trial. It would go from indictment up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I'll give Bush something to think about for a couple years.
Luckily, we have a young president in Mr. Bush. But let me ask you, what about the role of Congress here? I mean, wouldn't some people say, well, you're putting too much on Bush here. Congress did approve this war, and they had actually read, at least some of them supposedly should have read, the National Intelligence Estimate or whatever it was.
About 6 out of 500 of them that read it.
Right. Yeah. So what do you think of the role of Congress here? I mean, could they be indicted as well, or what?
No. There's no criminal intent. They may be slovenly and lazy and incompetent and all that stuff, but that in no way exonerates Bush's criminality. As you know, it's standard criminal law that fraud vitiates, and for your audience, fraud negates consent. Any consent induced by fraud goes out the window. On June 16th, I got a phone call here in my home from, I didn't solicit it, I was kind of surprised, from a very conservative Southern Republican congressman who voted for the war a very you'd know his name if I mentioned, a very vocal supporter of the war. He told me he listened to the tape of my book and that he was convinced that Bush, he didn't mention the American people, but he said he was convinced that Bush misled Congress into war. And he said he had bought several copies of the book, gave them to colleagues in Congress, two of whom I know, and told them, read the book, we've been lied to. Now, what was some of that evidence? Well, for instance, the white paper. He learned for the first time that that white paper that Congress saw never had the conclusion of 16 U.S. intelligence agencies that Hussein was not an imminent threat. He learned for the first time that flat-out conclusions in the white paper that Hussein had chemical and biological weapons were preceded in the classified document by words like, we assess that, we judge that. So opinions were changed into facts. He learned that for the first time. He learned that there were dissents in the classified document totally deleted in the white paper. And he was hard on himself. He said, there's no excuse for my not going up to the Senate Select Committee and reading the report. But, you know, one excuse for them is we've never had a monstrous president like George Bush take this nation to war before. So you make the assumption that the president is telling you the truth. They had no reason to disbelieve what he was saying. What other American president in history has taken this nation to war under false pretenses? I know the allegation about LBJ in the Gulf of Tonkin, and I cover that all in the end note. There's no credible evidence that any American president took this nation to war under false pretenses. No credible evidence that I know of. And if you want to make the assumption, just for sake of argument, arguendo, to use a legal term, that LBJ took this nation to war in Vietnam under false pretenses. No evidence at all, but let's make the assumption. So what? Is Bush going to get up in court and say, Your Honor, LBJ took the nation to war under false pretenses, and he got by with it, so why can't I? It's no defense. It's no defense. I think I've got the goods on the guy, and I'm going to go after him. I don't like to see anyone get away with murder, not even one murder. Simpson got away with two murders, and I got so angry I wrote a book, Outrage, The Five Reasons Why O.J. Simpson Got Away with Murder. So you can imagine the way I feel about Bush, who got away with over 100,000 murders and had a ball throughout the whole period of the war.
Vincent, what has the response been?
This book was completely, and that's, I'm not exaggerating here, completely blacked out by the mainstream media. With every other book of mine, I started out in New York City on national television. Here, I didn't even go to New York City. Completely blacked out to the point where ABC Radio refused to take money from my publisher to take out a radio spot on ABC Radio.
Wow.
It's opened up a little bit right now because of the article, the big article in the New York Times, talking about the blackout. So I'm going to be on CNN tomorrow, and I was on the Scarborough show a day or so ago. So it's opening up a little bit, but the blackout was complete. I had a very difficult time getting this book published. Never had that problem before.
Well, you had the biggest selling true crime book in the history of America with Helter Skelter. It's amazing that they wouldn't publicize this.
I couldn't even get an audio at the beginning. I never even thought about that before. My previous book, Reclaiming History and the Assassination of President Kennedy, Simon & Schuster did it. Never gave it a thought. This time I get a call from my New York City agent, Peter Miller, saying, Vince, I can't get any audio company in America to do the audio on this book. So the BBC did it. And the BBC audio is the one that this Republican congressman heard. There's a documentary on my book for the big screen in production right now. The producers couldn't raise one penny in America. The money had to come in from Canada.
Huh.
So we're supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, but everyone is frightened stiff of taking on George Bush. And people say how courageous I am. I'm not courageous. I don't view myself as a courageous guy at all. I'm motivated solely and simply by anger. I don't want this guy to get away with murder.
What about Cheney?
Well, Cheney would be prosecuted, too. I don't think there's any question Bush did not act alone, and the indictment would be certainly against Cheney and Rice. We don't know what would come out at the grand jury. Rove is probably in over his head. Rumsfeld, I don't know. I have a sense about...
Well, Michael will help you with Rumsfeld.
That's right. Yeah, we don't know what would come out at the grand jury. I have a sense about Paul that his only sin was weakness, but that would all come out at the grand jury, you know.
It's really been great to talk to you. We've been talking to Vincent Bugliosi, author of this incredible book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Vincent has said what basically almost no one else in this country is willing to say or willing to hear, but it's getting traction now, and we really recommend it.
even before the New York Times article, it became a New York Times bestseller. But right now, it's probably going to come out next week, maybe five or six on the New York Times bestseller list.
That's great.
So it's selling well.
Well, that's wonderful. That's really great. Congratulations.
It's people like you folks. It's people like you folks that are helping.
Well, that we do have a somewhat good alternative media in the U.S. that actually gets things going sometimes when the regular media doesn't. So thank you for this book.
Thanks so much for having
you.
Me on the show.
Thank you.
I deeply appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Best of luck to you. Bye, Vince.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Asiko mi lode mo so fun e ko gbo Ori mi ko deru pa mi se mo dupe Owo tuntun wole fun mi Amo tuntun wole se mo dupe Asiko mi wa ba te gba mu se Oyo oyo